the speech of his life. "Yep," Skippy said. "Seems to be a glitch somewhere. I'm working on it." Just then, every screen on the bridge and CIC began playing the video from the beginning. Chotek saw his image altered to appear as a vampire, saying, "I would like to address the crew." He was not amused. His face red, he glared at me. "Colonel Bishop, I would like to speak with you privately." Crap. Now he was pissed at me. We still had half an hour before the ship would jump, so I gave the command chair to Chang, and Chotek came into my office around the corner. The door was barely closed when he started haranguing me. "Colonel Bishop, I will not tolerate a display of disrespect like that. I am a senior United Nations official." Skippy made a raspberry sound. "Please, Chalky, you're a senior bureaucrat or a senior blowhard for sure, but what qualifies you to be part of this elite crew?" "My most recent assignment was in the Middle East. It took me 5 weeks, but I was able to negotiate a very difficult ceasefire between the Israelis and Palestinians," he said proudly. "Sure," Skippy scoffed, "except that nobody actually ceased firing during that ceasefire. Basically, they stopped shooting just long enough to eat lunch and reload. Then your ceasefire was over. What really happened is the two sides strung you along for 5 weeks while they shot at each other all they wanted. Then when they each needed a break, they agreed to your ceasefire agreement and ignored it. What else you got in your resume?" "The peace accords in Sudan." "Aha. You mean one side in Sudan agreeing to peace only after they had already killed or driven away 70% of the other side? Man, that must have been one tough agreement to negotiate." Chotek stiffened. "Not every agreement is what we wish it could. None of your negotiated agreements have accomplished anything useful, Chalky. You couldn't even do disaster aid right. When you were in charge of the tsunami relief in the Philippines, more than half of your supplies were stolen by terrorist groups. The emergency shelter housing units you brought in were contaminated with toxic mold, and your UN relief troops infected the native population with cholera. The Philippines would have been better off if you had never, quote, helped them, unquote." "It is easy to criticize in retrospect what should have been done. It is even easier to claim you are a big-shot UN official helping the world, when the truth is you have never accomplished one damned thing of substance in your worthless career, Chocula." Skippy was pissed. "Now you come aboard our ship when you are in no way qualified to join the merry band of pirates, and you think your experience gives you the authority to tell us what we can and can't do? Screw that! Where was your lazy ass the last two times we saved your miserable planet?" Chotek didn't have an answer to that. Although, to be fair, there wasn't a reasonable answer to that. "Skippy," I interrupted before the argument got totally out of control. "Damn it, we haven't even left orbit yet. This ship is under the authority of UNEF Command. I am also under that authority. Mr. Chotek has been appointed as the mission commander, and I have agreed to implement his commands as the captain of this ship. I did not say whether I like it or not, because everyone knew that is what I meant. Mr. Chotek, I had nothing to do with altering that video. I have been a victim of Skippy's pranks before. In my case, my image was replaced by Barney, the idiotic purple dinosaur. And a monkey, Joe, don't forget about the monkey," Skippy said gleefully. "Believe me, I have not forgotten about the monkey. My point, Mr. Chotek, is that you will need to reach some agreement with Skippy. You are an expert negotiator? And then find some way to reach an accommodation with him, because Skippy is 100% essential to operating this ship. No one else on board, including myself, are that vital to the mission." Chotek had his arms folded across his chest, which I took as a bad sign. "Mr. Skippy has made it clear that he has no need to negotiate with anyone. Therefore, I do not see any basis for reaching an agreement of any kind." "You don't need to reach a formal agreement," I suggested. "You just need to find a way to live together on this ship. It would help, sir, if you would develop a sense of humor about your interactions with our super-powerful alien being." I described Skippy that way to remind Chotek of exactly who he was dealing with. Given what I'd seen of Chotek so far, I was not optimistic about him growing a sense of humor. Skippy and Chotek were going to argue, and I was going to be caught in the middle. This could be a very long trip. Fort Rakovsky, Lemuria, Paradise. "Damn, I'm hungry," Dave said quietly. "Sorry, man, I know you're hungry, too. I shouldn't have mentioned it." "Hey." Jesse offered a hand, and he and Dave bumped fists. "Don't worry about it, Ski. If you can't talk about it with me, you can't talk about it with anyone. Being part of a fire team meant taking care of each other, and not just in combat. It meant making sure the other guys changed their socks so they didn't get blisters. It meant checking they were staying hydrated and eating nutritious food instead of junk. Although there wasn't any junk food on Paradise now, so that last one was easy. And it meant listening when a fire team member needed to talk about something. Yeah, I'm hungry too. And we're better off than most. Because they worked on a dedicated ag team as chicken ranchers, Dave and Jesse were allotted extra calories each day. That allotment had been cut 3 times, so that now their daily bounty was a mere 300 additional calories. Part of the reason for the cuts was that, with most of UNEF now settled in villages that had been carved out of Paradise's southern continent, the majority of humans were now involved in farming and raising animals. Most people were on ag teams by default. It was no longer a special assignment. The other reason was that even though UNEF had cleared thousands of acres and planted crops, the food supply was still tight. UNEF had quickly found that in addition to growing crops for the general supply, each ag worker needed to be allotted a certain number of acres just for themselves as an incentive. People worked for incentives. That was why communism had been such a miserable and obvious failure. While soldiers could be ordered by headquarters to grow food for the general population, most people worked just a little bit harder on land they knew was their own. On their own plot of land, they grew whatever crops they wanted, assuming seeds were available. A new, informal human economy was being built on Paradise, based on trading food products. One village may grow a field of sugarcane on their private allotment. After harvest and processing, the resulting raw sugar could be traded for just about anything. A dairy needed a large amount of grain to feed the cattle. Incoming grain was traded for fresh milk. And not just milk was traded. There was a booming business in butter and cheese. One village, located right on the equator of Paradise, grew nothing but peppers and traded dried pepper flakes to spice up the mostly bland diet people were eating. "You know what I miss?" Dave asked while staring off into the cornfield. 2/3 of the field was laying fallow in between harvests, waiting for more fertilizer to be delivered. Corn kernels were harvested, mostly to feed the chickens, and the upper parts of the corn stalks were shipped out as feed for cattle. Cows shouldn't eat the lower part of a corn stalk, Dave had been told. It contained too much nitrates or something like that. That was yet another thing he hadn't expected to learn in the U.S. Army. He also had learned how to select and prepare corn to be used as seeds for the next harvest. None of this had been covered in basic training. The reason most of the field was not growing corn at the moment was simple and frightening. Large fields of crops were big, easy targets for Krestang maser beams. The raider ships that were still regularly popping into orbit were hitting the human food supply as often as they targeted Ruhar infrastructure. In response, UNEF had ordered creation of smaller, widely scattered fields to avoid providing tempting targets for the Krestang raiders. Creating those fields took time and intense labor, and that took effort away from tending the fields that were already planted. The acres now under cultivation were supposedly enough to feed all of UNEF, with a safety margin for bad weather, crop failures, and fields burned by Krestang masers. An adequate supply of food was mere months away, according to UNEF HQ. Whether that was true or BS propaganda to boost sagging morale depended on which rumors you believed. "What you miss?" Jesse asked. "Like, getting enough to eat?"
"That too," Dave nodded.
"I miss food from home. You don't eat corn and eggs in Milwaukee?" Jesse had eaten plenty of corn in Arkansas, mostly in the form of cornmeal, cornbread, corn in a lot of things. Like his nickname, Cornpone. He'd eaten a lot of eggs, too. And now he was heartily sick of both corn and eggs. Ski had cooked up a deal to trade some of their private crops like sun-dried tomatoes for sugar, spices, and even a tiny chunk of cheese made right on Paradise. In their little spare time, they had cleared a field together and planted a type of wheat as an experiment. If it worked, they were hoping to have wheat flour and possibly even wheat bread to trade.
"You know what I mean. I miss the kind of food we don't have here. Like beer brats."
"Beer brats? Like bratwurst? That's German food, right? You're Polish. I thought you guys ate kielbasa."
"We do. My father's family is Polish. My mother comes from French Canadian and Swedish people. And I'm like fourth generation American. They came over from Poland a long time ago. Beer brats are a Wisconsin thing." How do you cook them?
Jesse didn't actually care how bratwursts were cooked. He knew Ski wanted to talk about it. Dave's eyes lit up.
What my folks do is you get a pan, like an aluminum pan. The thin disposable kind like they sell lasagna in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you'll probably throw the pan away because it will get sooty from the grill.
Okay. You got the pan, you slice up onions, and you add the brats and pour beer in to cover the brats.
Jesse looked skeptical.
Sounds like a waste of good beer.
It doesn't take a whole lot of beer, and you don't have to use the good stuff. A dark beer is best. It adds more flavor. You cover the pan with foil and let it kind of poach or steam for a while.
You kind of boil the brats?
Why not do it on a stove instead of a grill?
Because before you serve the brats, you take them out of the pan and grill them up for a few minutes. It gets the skin nice and crispy, so that when you bite into them, the juice bursts in your mouth. Oh.
Ski closed his eyes and licked his lips, almost tasting a delicious brat.
Put them on a bun, add the onions on top. Man, that tastes like...
Dave paused, lost for a moment as a shadow fell across his face.
It tastes like home, man. I know what you mean.
That sounds good. I'd like to try that.
Except we don't have brats or beer.
We have onions.
Yum, Dave said with disgust.
What food do you miss the most?
Oh, dang. There's so much.
Jesse caught himself before saying chicken and dumplings while he stood over the pen of tiny peeping chicks. That would have been very bad luck.
Ribs. I miss baby back ribs. Memphis style?
Of course.
Or a dry rub, that's good too.
Mmm. Dave smacked his lips.
I can taste it now.
Me too.
We've served together a long time. How come back when Bishop named you Ski, you didn't tell him that you're half Swedish?
Like that would have made a difference.
With Joe?
Eh, no, I guess not.
Sucks what happened to him. Goddamn lizards killed him.
Dave frowned.
I think technically the hamsters killed him when they blew up that jail he was in.
Bullshit, Jesse. That was timing. The lizards were going to kill him anyway. The reason he is dead is because of the lizards.
Yeah, Cornpone agreed with a frown.
Yeah.
I miss his stupid face sometimes.
Bish.
A colonel.
Jesse shook his head in amazement.
He was one lucky son of a bitch. Until, you know, he got killed.
Flying Dutchman. Following the initial jump, the ship was recharging jump drive capacitors, so I took the opportunity to get dinner. It had been a long day, and I was on the third and last shift for dinner in the galley. Hopefully not all the good stuff was gone by then. It was the Chinese team's turn to cook, and to my surprise, they made meatloaf. There were also two vegetarian dishes.
Chinese meatloaf?
The cook offered it to me with pride, so I took the plate and added some sort of vegetables. On our last mission, someone on the American team had added nutmeg to the meatloaf, so I tasted this Chinese version with skepticism.
It was delicious. Different, but delicious. And spicy.
The meatloaf on my plate was gone before I knew it. The cook, beaming with pride, offered me a second helping, which I accepted.
Hey, Colonel Joe, Skippy said through the ceiling speaker. I need a favor.
Mentally, I cringed, because Skippy had often used my time in the galley to tease and insult me in front of an audience.
What is it?
I need you to order Dr. Friedlander to tell me the punchline to the joke he started. That freaking weasel keeps telling me that he's too busy managing the science team.
I won't order him to tell you, but I can certainly ask him about it.
Maybe I can help you. What is the joke?
He said, how do you keep an idiot in suspense?
Thank God that I didn't have a mouthful of food, because I burst out laughing, and so did everyone in the galley.
Sergeant Adams was laughing so hard she had tears running down her face. Captain Giroux almost fell off his chair.
What's so funny? Skippy demanded.
When I could talk again, I said gently, Skippy, think about it. After a long pause, there came,
oh, shit.
Then he shouted,
Friedlander!
Joe. We need the ship to alter course immediately.
Why?
There is a planet I know of that has large beasts, sort of like dinosaurs. We're going to dip Friedlander in ketchup and drop him off there.
Skippy, come on. I promised the guy that he would not be eaten by a giant space lizard. You promised him I didn't. Ooh, that weasel is going to seriously regret the day he was born when... Thank you for the laugh, Skippy. I'm sure you can find some non-lethal means to get even with our local rocket scientist. The third morning after we jumped away from Earth, I had a problem to deal with. Count Chocula came to my office before I even had a sip of coffee. He complained he didn't get any sleep that night because his cabin was alternately broiling hot, then freezing cold at night, then the ventilation system made booming noises. He asked me to tell Skippy to stop harassing him, then he went away to get the cup of coffee I hadn't had yet. As soon as he went around the corner, I called a shiny beer can that I know. Hey, Skippy. Count Chocula says the ventilation in his cabin went haywire last night.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. It's a damn shame, is what it is. The ventilation system in that area has issues.
Issues?
Yep. Multiple issues, let me tell you. The ventilation system's sister is dating some creepy goth guy. Its mother lost her job and is drinking too much again. The whole family is worried. Although, let's face it, the mother has been through rehab twice already, so it's no surprise. She's not going to change. And the ventilation system itself is having a bad hair day. Plus, it gained weight after it broke up with its boyfriend last week. Oh man, it's a whole deal.
We're talking daytime TV-type drama in that family.
Okay, sure. I couldn't help laughing.
Any chance you can fix just one issue? Keep the temperature in that cabin at a comfortable level?
I could, I suppose. Tell you what, I'll put it on my list of things to do. Although there are so many other things I need to do that are a much higher priority.
Such as?
Well, Joe, your sock drawer is shockingly disorganized. You've got dress socks mixed up with sport socks, man. It could take me months to untangle that mess. The ventilation system in his cabin may have to wait a while.
Listen, Skippy, I don't like the jerk either. I craned my neck to see if anyone was in the corridor outside my office.
But you can't harass him that way. He needs sleep. Lack of sleep won't improve his personality.
You have a point there, Joe. Until I get the ventilation system fixed, I suggest he finds a nice airlock to sleep in. Although we've had trouble with airlocks also, it is possible there could be a catastrophic failure someday. I can't promise anything.
Then tell me this, genius. What are the odds of an airlock failing while Chocula happens to be sleeping there and him getting sucked out into space?
Difficult to say for certain, Joe. There are a lot of variables involved. I can tell you that there does seem to be an odd correlation between the potential of an airlock failure and how much I am irritated at Chotek that particular day. It is a strange coincidence. I can't explain it. This could take some detailed analysis.
I sighed. This was going to be an ongoing problem.
Please, Skippy, for me, let the guy get a good night of sleep, okay?
Fine, he huffed. Have it your way. I'll find some other way to have fun.
Great. Don't make it so obvious next time.
Fort Rakovsky, Lemuria, Paradise.
Their private wheat field was coming along just fine, according to the ag expert who stopped by their village once a week. Jesse and Dave were discussing combining forces with another three guys to expand their wheat field. Five guys working together could grow more than two plus three working separately. People were doing that all over Lemuria. The crops growing in their allotted private fields were now almost equal to the yield from official communal fields. Dave had originally wanted to grow oats, figuring it would be an advantage to grow something not many other people were growing. The ag expert had shot down that idea, explaining that oats were a cool season crop, unsuited to growing in the tropical jungle of Paradise's southern continent, because the oat plant goes dormant in high temperatures. That was too bad, because Dave had been hoping for a nice bowl of oatmeal someday. Back on Earth, oatmeal had not been his favorite food, but he was fixated on it now. Of all the wide variety of foods he missed, a bowl of oatmeal seemed reasonably achievable, unlike, for example, pepperoni pizza. Why waste time and effort yearning for something he was never, ever going to have again? Jesse wanted to expand their private field to grow some corn of their own in addition to wheat, intending to someday produce grits. Grits, Jesse said, would be a big seller. Dave supposed Jesse was right about that, but he still was feeling nostalgic about a bowl of oatmeal, like his mother used to make on cold winter mornings in Milwaukee. To make the experience complete, he needed milk, which was not as scarce on Paradise as it used to be, now that cows were producing high yields.
Rumor had it that their own village would be getting a cow soon, in exchange for 2 dozen egg-laying chickens. Dave also needed brown sugar. Sugarcane was being grown on Paradise, and their friendly local ag expert had told Dave the sugarcane was growing well. Very well. It would not be too long, another month perhaps, before human-produced sugar was available. Dave envied the guys who were growing sugarcane. Those guys could command anything in trade for sugar if they were smart enough to grow some sugarcane on their private fields. In fact, Dave had thought of trying to grow sugarcane with Jesse instead of wheat. Unfortunately, they had learned that processing the cane into sugar was so very labor and energy intensive, it was not worth doing in small-scale operation. Someday, maybe. Someday in the future. So, Dave's theoretical bowl of oatmeal, a bowl of nostalgia, could have milk and sugar on Paradise. What he lacked were oats. If there were any oats on Paradise, they were in a UNEF warehouse, and that food was carefully guarded. Unless the hamsters allowed humans to grow food in temperate areas of the northern continent, he was not getting any oats within his lifetime. However long that was. Flying Dutchman. Skippy, we need to decide how we're going to find out what the Thorana know about that surveyor ship we destroyed. Before we left Earth, many plans had been discussed, but no final decision had been made, of course. UNEF Command wanted Chotek, with my advice, to make the call. I do not like the idea of us having to assault a Thoranan data relay station. It is too risky. The science team suggested...
A science team?
Let me guess. They have some moronic idea about me magically retrieving the vital information we need. Probably they expect me to stealthily zoom past some random Thoranan ship and glean what we need from the databanks in like 2 seconds.
No.
My interruption was ignored. He was on a roll, so I let him talk. As I explained like 100 freaking times already, that won't work. The reason I was able to quickly get the data we needed from that Thoranan tanker ship on our last mission is because I knew the coordinates for rendezvous with the surveyor ship would be in the tanker's navigation computer. I knew exactly where to look and what to look for, and the data was only concealed behind low-level encryption. The rendezvous coordinates may as well have been in a folder marked, Skippy, look here. He paused.
Joe, you're not going to interrupt me with an unhelpful comment?
No, Skippy, I can tell you're on a roll. Go ahead.
Oh.
This is unexpected. I don't know what to say.
Darn it, I had several snappy comebacks prepared, and now I can't use them.
Well, I'll save them for later. What is the science team's suggestion? Dr. Friedlander and I have had several conversations during which I shot down many, many idiotic plans they dreamed up.
The idea I want to ask you about is whether you could, as you say, magically fly by a random Thoranan ship. Only instead of you trying to find the data we need in a few seconds, you use that time to load a virus or a worm or whatever you called it into the ship's computer. That worm would propagate from ship to ship, looking for the data we need. When the worm has it, it would cause ships to drop flight recorder drones at a couple coordinates in deep space. The Dutchman could then go to one of those coordinates and pick up the data whenever we wanted.
I agree that is a great concept, and I congratulated the science team for thinking up a clever idea. Clever, but unworkable. When I flew by that tanker, I did upload a program which caused that ship to drop off flight recorder drones every time, before the ship jumped. The reason that worked is because my program was only resident in the tanker's computer for a short time because, you know, we blew up that ship soon after. The AIs aboard Thoranan ships do not compare to me in any way, but they are also not stupid. Because my program altered the normal operation of the ship's AI would have detected it eventually, probably within a week to 12 days. A program which only sat quietly looking for data would be able to conceal itself longer. So the problem with the science team's clever idea is that such a program would work for a while, then the Thoranan would detect it. They would then not only erase the program from any infected ship, they would analyze the program to determine its purpose. What would happen then is they would likely figure out that the program was designed to drop off drones at specific coordinates, and they would surround each of those coordinates with a heavy battle group. The Flying Dutchman would jump in, be trapped by a damping field, and we would be destroyed.
Crap.
Joe, if there was any easy solution, I would have told you. Besides, it's your job to dream up crazy, out-of-the-box, monkey-brained ideas. You mean to tell me you haven't thought of an easy way to do this?
No, I admitted.
I am disappointed in you, Joe. Skippy, I can't make ideas happen whenever I want. They just do. Or don't, in this case.
Then, we have to do it the hard way, Skippy said with a touch of sadness. The only way to be sure we will find the data we need is to access the communications files of a Theranan data relay station. Because those stations transmit powerful signals, they are heavily shielded, so even I can't access the files from the outside. I need to get inside, and that means we need to physically assault, board, and take control of a station. Joe, I fear there will be many casualties among our brave special forces.
Me too, Skippy. Me too.
Major Smythe's Spec Ops team leaders had been analyzing the three most common types of Theranan data relay stations, trying to find a way in that would not lead to a certain slaughter of our forces. So far, they were not confident.
It has to be a data relay station. We can't take over a Theranan ship, maybe a soft target like a civilian transport.
No, Joe, I am sorry. If that were possible, I would have mentioned it as an option. Because the Theranan have been hit so badly by the Giraptha in this sector, there is little Theranan civilian traffic. What few civilian ships that are flying always have military escorts, and a civilian ship is unlikely to carry classified military data. Before you ask, I did consider us somehow capturing a small warship such as a frigate. How to do that would be your problem. That idea I quickly discarded because there is no way to know beforehand whether any particular ship contains the data we are seeking. That ship might not have access to classified data, or that ship might belong to a battle group that had not yet been informed about the surveyor ship, or the Theranan may still be puzzling over the fate of the surveyor ship and may not have informed the fleet about it. We might take a significant risk to capture a ship that doesn't have any useful data for us. Then we would have to keep capturing one ship after another.
No, that won't work at all. We can't go randomly capturing ships, hoping they contain the data we need. We need the data to come to us. We need to seize a data relay station.
Skippy had explained to UNEF Command that because the Theranan didn't have faster-than-light communications, they needed starships to carry message traffic from one star system to another or between battle groups of their far-flung fleet. To facilitate regular communications, the Theranan had built space stations as data relays and scattered them throughout their territory. Most of the relay stations were in heavily trafficked star lanes, often located near clusters of wormholes. Unless ships were on especially urgent or clandestine missions, they were expected to jump in near a relay station and exchange data. A place where Theranan ships regularly visited would be a tempting target for the Giraptha, but the Giraptha weren't interested in attacking the stations, only the warships that visited such stations. Destroying a relay station would be counterproductive for the Giraptha. Theranan warships wouldn't have a reason to make themselves temporarily vulnerable by stopping there. Accordingly, although most Theranan relay stations were equipped with heavy armor and shields, they were very rarely attacked. Once we boarded a relay station and took control, Skippy could ransack their data files at leisure to find the data we needed. Even better, he could erase the resident AI and replace it with a submind of his own. Then, if the station did not already contain all the data we needed when we arrived, we could abandon the station, leave the submind in place, and back the Dutchman away. Theranan ships would fly by, exchanging data, never knowing the station was under human control. When the submind received the data we needed, it would ping us. Even after we got that data, we could leave the submind in place, periodically jumping back in so Skippy could ransack any new files. The relay station would be like humanity having a direct tap into the enemy's data network, and we could keep it until that station was scheduled to rotate crews, at which point there would be an unfortunate and fatal accident with its reactor. Skippy hoped the Theranan had purchased insurance. The problem for Major Smythe and me was to select one particular relay station to target for assault. Skippy had extensive data on all the Theranan relay stations. It was up to Smythe and me to choose one to hit. We, mostly Smythe, had developed three criteria for selecting a target. First, we needed a relay station that didn't have too much traffic, because we could not have Theranan ships jumping in to exchange data during our assault and for at least a couple days later. Skippy needed time to load his submind into the Theranan computer, which he expected to be typically crappy and inadequate. And we would need time to make cosmetic repairs to the exterior of the station to avoid visiting Theranan ships from asking awkward questions. Second, the relay station needed to be of a particular type. Of the three standard Theranan designs for relay stations, Smythe and his team had quickly rejected two types as being too large, staffed with too many little green men, and having extensive internal defenses. These two types of relay stations tended to be older, from when their Theranan designers had been worried about defending against Giraptha attempts to board and capture a station.
In the past several hundred years, as it became clear the Theranin had no interest in boarding what was basically a radio floating in deep space, the Theranin had begun building a new design. This newer type of station was significantly smaller and required a much smaller crew. The designers had basically taken obsolete cruisers, removed the engines, added shielding to protect the crew from the powerful transmissions, and made a few more tweaks to create a cheap and simple relay station. This type of station did not have the internal armor and killing zones that could trap our special forces as they attempted to force their way to capture the station's core where the AI resided. And the third criteria was that the station must have a relatively fresh crew with many months before that crew was scheduled to rotate out and be replaced by a new group of little green men. That would give the submind plenty of time to skim data and find everything we needed, and hopefully more. The burden of selecting a shortlist of relay stations from Smythe's criteria fell on Skippy. "Have you found some Theranin data relays that are good targets for us?" I asked. "Yes, I did, and I have great news for you, Joey. All of these particular relay stations are Pokestops." "What's a Pokestop?" "Come on, Joey. It's where you collect rare Pokemonsters." "Pokemon? Anyone?" "Anyone?" Skippy asked in frustration. "It's an old game, Joe. Oh, forget it. Damn, sometimes you are so stupid that it's not any fun to insult you." "Wow. You're saying that being stupid is an advantage." "What? No, I did not say that, you dum-dum. Man, there are times..." He sighed, then sobbed quietly. "Oh, why am I stuck on a pirate ship with a bunch of flea-bitten monkeys? I must have been a truly awful person in a previous life to deserve this terrible fate." "An awful person like what?" I was going to suggest an arrogant AI, but he interrupted me. "You know, Joe, someone who takes joy in making people suffer. I'm talking pure evil here, like a customer service rep for the cable company." "Ha!" I laughed. "Even you could never be that evil, Skippy." "Thank you for the reassurance, Joe. To be serious for a moment, based on your first two criteria, there are 23 data relay stations that are perfect candidates for us, I think. You and Major Smythe will need to look at them and decide." Whittling down the list of candidates was great. We still feared heavy casualties in taking the station. "Even with this newer type of relay station," I asked, "you can do your Sandman trick?" My hope was that Skippy could repeat the technique he had used to capture the Flying Dutchman, hacking into the Theranin's AI and ordering all the little green men to go into sleep mode. After he'd done that, all we had to do was drag their sleeping, drooling bodies to a cargo hold. "Sorry, Joe, the answer is no," Skippy said with regret. "Even that smaller type of station has heavy internal shielding. I couldn't access the entire structure from any one point, and as soon as we fire a shot, the Theranin will go into combat protocol, which disables their sleep function. I wish I could do that for you. Sorry." "Oh, it's not your fault, Skippy. Without you, none of this would be possible." "That internal shielding also means our combat operators will need to be inside the station," he warned, "close behind their machines. That way I will be able to facilitate the interaction between operator and combat." "We understand. That's still 23 possible targets. Can you narrow the list further using our third criteria?" "Sure, Joe, I can do that. After I get the data on Theranin fleet deployment plans and crew rotation schedules for those 23 relay stations. So at the moment the answer is no. I told you we have to get that data from a Theranin ship somewhere, somehow." "All right, I hear you. You need more data, and we need a plan to get it. Fine. When we do get that data and you give us a smaller list, I need to speak with Smythe. We will recommend 2 or 3 relay stations from your list. Then Chotek has to make the decision." Skippy snorted. "Is our resident bureaucrat qualified to make military decisions, Joe?" "No. But if there's not much difference between the stations on the final list, we may as well flip a coin. I want him to be part of making the decision. I want him to know that if there are casualties, he had a hand in it. I'm not covering my ass, Skippy. I want Chotek to know what it feels like to make life and death decisions." Chapter 7. Paradise. Captain Nivelle accepted the Burgermeister's offer of hot water to make tea, and scattered some precious tea leaves into his cup. The tea would have hardly any taste, and that didn't matter. To the Ruhar, it was the ritual of drinking tea that was important.
"Thank you, Madame Logelia. I have been considering something you said during our last conversation. What would be involved if our force declared loyalty to the Ruhar? And what would be the implications to our people here and on Earth? I assume the Kristang would learn of our switching sides.
She looked out the window.
It is a fine day. We should go for a walk.
It was not a particularly fine day, being overcast with the skies threatening rain and a chill in the morning air. They walked out of the building, down a road, then turned to walk along a dirt lane separating two fields. One of the fields was ready for harvest. It contained some kind of grain like wheat or oats. The other field was in the process of being planted. A large machine was rolling along the rows at the far end of the field. From the field, Nivelle caught a whiff of whatever fertilizer the Ruhar used. It smelled vaguely like Parmesan cheese, and to Nivelle's nose, unpleasant. He ignored it. Reports had come into UNFHQ that some Ruhar who had contact with human soldiers mentioned the scarcity of fertilizer on Paradise. A Kristang raiding ship had hit a fertilizer factory 6 months ago, and the local Ruhar were complaining that their government was very slow to rebuild it. The local Ruhar were unhappy about many things, according to rumors that Nivelle gave credence to. The government was not making enough of an effort to rebuild and enhance infrastructure. The schedule for bringing back native Ruhar who had been evacuated was far too slow, and the schedule kept slipping. And most importantly, the local Ruhar complained that their fleet, which had recently won crushing victories, did not seem able or willing to protect them from what surely must be a small group of Kristang starships. When they had walked half a kilometer down the lane, talking about nothing but the weather, Logelia decided it was time to discuss the important subject.
"General, it is unfortunate that I ever mentioned to you the possibility of your force switching allegiances in this war. I mentioned our conversation to my superiors, and they were dismayed the subject had been discussed at all. If you were to formally offer to change sides, I am afraid to tell you that the Ruhar government would not welcome it. My government would not accept the humans on Gitanu as clients at the present time. If the offer had been extended earlier, such as soon after our fleet regained control of Gitanu, the answer might have been different. Under the current circumstances, it is not possible."
"Why? Has something changed in the strategic situation in this sector?"
"I should not be telling you this officially, and you must promise me that you will keep this a very closely held secret, General."
"You have my word as a French soldier," General Nivelle said, mildly offended.
"First, I must tell you that your communications are thoroughly compromised by my people. There are even nanoscale recording devices in some of your clothing. The devices embedded in the collar of your uniform have been disabled temporarily." She pointed to her own Z-phone. "Any repetition of this conversation must be conducted with extreme caution."
"Understood," Nivelle agreed, suddenly feeling his collar itching his neck. "And agreed.
Cool, as your people say. General, my government, I refer to the federal government, not the planetary administration. The Ruhar federal government has been engaged in negotiations to give Gitanu, this planet, back to the Kristang."
Nivelle almost choked on his complete shock.
"Sacre bleu! Why?"
Logelia explained the strategic situation.
"You must understand that my government never intended to recapture Gitanu in the last campaign. In short, General, this planet is not worth the military effort that would be required to keep it."
Nivelle was stunned. The entire Ruhar campaign to retake Paradise had been a ruse to draw in the Theranin and Kristang, and now the Ruhar wished to give the planet away?
"Personally," she continued, "I am opposed to any notion of surrendering my home planet. I was born here, and my mother was born here. Mine is only one voice. I am not even allowed to tell the local population about the negotiations. These raids by the Kristang," she looked at the clouds, "only serve to reinforce my government's decision to trade away this planet."
Nivelle was greatly disturbed and chose his words carefully.
"Your government would not welcome and would not accept our pledge of loyalty because that would make them responsible for the humans here?"
"It would make us responsible, yes. All Ruhar. On this world, the issue of humans is important. Away from this star system, most of my people have never heard of humans. Or if they have, All they know is that humans serve our enemy. To accept your allegiance would mean my government accepts the tremendous expense of evacuating humans from this planet, and they would have to be resettled on a Ruhar world, where the local population would probably not be pleased to find an enemy in their midst. For my government, there is, as I believe your people say, no upside for this. We gain nothing by accepting your force as clients.
General Nivelle could not argue with her hard, cold logic. It made sense. It also meant disaster for his force.
Then it is good that I did not discuss the possibility of switching sides with anyone, not even my personal staff. I wanted to learn the implications from you first.
I do not know what impact there would be to Earth if you changed allegiances, because we do not know the situation on Earth. The Kristang there are cut off from the rest of their species after the wormhole shut down.
That is confirmed? It is not disinformation by the Kristang?
Nivelle asked anxiously. UNFHQ had heard rumors that the Kristang no longer had access to Earth. If it was true, then he needed to officially inform his troops before rumors got out of hand. Bad news, as the old saying went, did not improve with age.
The wormhole is in Kristang territory, she said, so we cannot verify it has truly gone dormant. However, I am told that we have very solid intelligence that the Kristang and Theranin have lost contact with your home planet.
Is that unusual for a wormhole to shut down like that?
It is very unusual. As we do not know how wormholes work, or why they have sudden shifts, we can't make any useful speculation about why that wormhole has ceased functioning. It may reactivate tomorrow, or it could signal another impending shift across the entire sector. We simply do not know.
General? She turned so they could walk back to her office. The sky was beginning to drizzle.
I am sorry about the situation you find yourself in. Your species did not ask to become part of this war. I do not have any advice for you. Having on my world a client species of our enemy is new to me. Again, I am sorry that you were drawn into this war.
Nivelle did not want to discuss regrets, he wanted to discuss action.
Do you know the status of the negotiations, the timeline for handing control of this planet to the Kristang?
My government has not consulted me, she said with a wry smile. So what I can tell you is from what I have heard from sources who are usually reliable. So far, the territory that the Kristang are offering in exchange for Gitanu is not sufficient, and the negotiations have been going back and forth. There are complicating factors. Although there is currently a limited ceasefire between the Jarraptha and the Theranin in this sector, it has not yet been agreed which territories the Jarraptha have captured. Some star systems the Jarraptha took control of during the conflict, they may wish to give back to the Theranin in exchange for other more valuable territory. The Jarraptha wish to consolidate their gains and draw a new, more defensible border. That new border may affect what territory the Kristang are able to offer us, or may affect the value of that territory. Because the Jarraptha captured a wormhole cluster from the Theranin, the Jarraptha now control access to territory that is not inside their borders.
She shook her head.
As I said, the situation is very complicated. The Commodore of our defense fleet, she pointed to the sky, has told me that he thinks the ongoing Kristang raids are not aimed at retaking the planet. The Kristang force here is not strong enough to do that. The raids are aimed at making my government more willing to accept a lesser bargain in exchange for this planet. General, the true problem we face, you humans and we native Ruhar, is that my government very much wants to trade away Gitanu. Therefore, eventually they will reach a deal with the Kristang, and my people will leave this world. As to your people, I do not know what will happen.
Flying Dutchman. While we still hadn't selected one particular relay station to hit, Major Smythe began planning the assault. Smythe was glum about our chances.
We can do it, sir, he told me without confidence. We can take the station. I expect casualties to be heavy. Once we get inside, it will be a short and bloody battle. We will have the advantage of initial surprise and numbers. Between our troops in armor suits and combat, we outnumber them 3-1.
The Theranin have the advantages of being genetically engineered cyborgs and being on the defensive. They know the terrain better than we do. I wish, he said while looking around the empty cargo bay we used for training, that we could build a replica of that relay station. It would be bloody helpful to train on the same ground where we'll be fighting.
Huh? He had given me a thought.
Hey, Skippy, this type of relay station we will be assaulting, they build a lot of them?
Yes, they are now the most numerous type of relay station, Joe, he confirmed. An entire class of cruisers became obsolete, and the Theranin used their obsolescence as an opportunity to create new relay stations.
Why? Are you not happy with our choice of target?
Unless our target was seizing control of a basket of kittens, I wouldn't be happy about it. No, it's not this particular station that bothers me. It's the high level of risk in the whole concept. My question is whether there are any of this type of station that have been abandoned because of battle damage or another reason.
Sure there are, Joe. Only one has sustained sufficient battle damage to warrant it being abandoned. It was self-destructed to prevent it from falling into enemy hands.
Ah, crap. I was hoping. He interrupted me again.
But there are seven others which have been abandoned after the recent wormhole shift because their location was deemed no longer useful.
Were those seven others also destroyed?
Not all of them. Two were blown up because they are now in Jarraptha territory. The other five were mothballed, in case another wormhole shift makes them useful again. Their reactors were shut down, and all computer communication and data storage capability was removed, but they are still there, drifting along in cold storage.
Great, I exulted. Major Smythe, instead of us building a replica, how would you like your team to practice the assault on an actual data relay station?
Whoa! Skippy shouted with a derisive laugh. Wait just a minute there, Joe. You can't just...
Maybe you can just do that.
Ah, damn it! The monkey says, duh, how about we do this, and he comes up with a good idea. Now why didn't I think of that? Stupid, stupid brain. Oh, I hate my life sometimes, he said with a sob.
Huh. Now I see why I didn't think of that. I knew about these abandoned stations, but removed them from my list because they are inactive.
That is interesting, Joe.
I'm sure it is, Skippy. That wormhole shift won't stop us from accessing one of those stations, will it?
Quite the contrary, Joe. There is one particular derelict station that was left totally isolated from both Theranin and Jarraptha territory by the wormhole shift. It took a Theranin ship almost 18 months to retrieve the station crew after they were cut off.
That station would be perfect for Major Smythe's team to practice. We would be assured of not having any visitors.
I can use our Elder Wormhole Controller Module to temporarily connect to that dormant wormhole so we can go through and on our way back.
Joe, he lamented. Do you do this sort of thing just to humiliate me?
No, Skippy, I assured him. Of course not. Humiliating you is a bonus. Major Smythe, you can work with this?
Brilliantly, sir.
We still have the hard part to do, I cautioned.
Yes, sir, Smythe nodded. But perhaps now it won't be quite so bloody hard.
I contacted the bridge and we changed course toward the derelict relay station. Of course, I caught hell from Chotek for not informing him about the change of plans before I ordered the course change. That pissed me off. I was on my way to his office to tell him personally, but that wasn't good enough. We had a discussion that ended with me deciding that in the future I would take the 30 seconds to contact him before I ordered a major course change. 30 seconds is all it would take for me to swallow my pride and avoid an argument. The whole situation still pissed me off. Paradise.
Can y'all believe this shit?
Jesse asked while staring at his e-phone in the hope that what he'd just read would change.
It's crazy, man, Dave replied, shaking his head.
No, Jesse looked up in frustration. I mean, do you believe it? Dave scrolled the screen to the top and pointed to the logo at the beginning of the message.
UNFHQ believes it. This is official.
That can't happen, can it? Jesse appealed for assurance. The message from UNFHQ stated that the wormhole that led back to Earth had closed, and the Kristang weren't able to reopen it. The expeditionary force on Paradise now had zero hope of ever getting home. Even if their former Kristang allies took Paradise back from the Ruhar, they could not bring humans back to Earth because the Kristang lacked the technology to make that long journey. Even for the advanced Theranin, such a voyage was wildly impractical.
Wormholes don't just shut down for no reason, Jess protested.
The one near Earth opened for no reason, Cornpone, Ski said gently.
That's what landed us in this mess in the first place.
That's bullshit, Eric Koblenz said, spitting on the ground for emphasis.
Eric was part of another three-man act team, a team that Jesse and Dave had partnered with to combine and expand their private plots of land into a significant field of wheat. The other two partners were good guys, but Eric had been a problem from the start. He did his share of the work. That wasn't the issue. The problem was that Eric was a keeper. Soon after the Ruhar took the planet back and UNFHQ ordered all humans to surrender, a movement called Keepers of the Faith had sprung up on the Z-Phone network. Keepers held that UNF should not have surrendered, that the Kristang were true allies, that the fortune cookie messages from Earth about the Kristang abusing humanity's home planet and enslaving the population were somehow all Ruhar lies, that UNF had come out to the stars to fight alongside the Kristang against the species that had attacked Earth, so UNF should keep doing that, fight the Ruhar. Even if the expeditionary force on Paradise was wiped out to the last human, UNF would demonstrate to our Kristang allies that humans kept their word, and such a demonstration of steadfastness and resolve would benefit humans back on Earth. To Keepers, everyone else were traitors.
That's all a lie by the hamsters, Eric spat again. And the UNF HQ lackeys are just selling out again as usual. The wormhole near Earth didn't just open up recently. That's a lie the hamsters told us to explain why the Kristang had not been to Earth before they did. And that wormhole is not shut down now. The hamsters want us to give up hope so we'll be easy to control, and you traitors are stupid enough to listen to these lies.
Oh, Dave sighed. Not this BS again. Look, man, if you want to talk about your wacko conspiracy theories, he pointed to the jungle, go put on your tinfoil hat and tell it to the trees, because I'm not wasting my time listening.
Traitor, Jesse asked angrily. You best be careful throwing around words like that, asshole. How exactly are we giving aid and comfort to the enemy?
Damn, Jesse, don't take the bait, Dave warned. But it was too late.
Eric put his arms across his chest.
You give aid and comfort every day by not resisting them. The Ruhar know that sheep like you will never fight them, so they don't have to garrison many troops here. You're growing your own food, so the Ruhar don't have to manufacture human food and ship it in.
Yeah, like you're not helping to grow food, Dave said sarcastically while pointing to Eric's hands, dirty from harvesting tomatoes and peppers from the fields.
And I've noticed you haven't refused to eat this food we grew with the hamster's help.
See, Jesse? That's how moronic the sleepers are.
Dave used the derisive nickname for the Kristang loyalists.
When we eat food we grew here, we're traitors. But when they do the exact same thing, they're loyal.
Talk all you want. The Ruhar are keeping troops here and ships in orbit because they know if they don't, we keepers will take the planet back. We are assisting the Kristang by making the Ruhar keep combat resources here.
Well, of course you are, Jesse scoffed. They're afraid of what? The hoe you use in the fields? No, it must be the shovel you were using this morning. Hey, genius, the Ruhar hold the high ground. They can sit in orbit and pound the crap out of us down here, and there ain't squat we can do about it unless you weave together corn stalks to make a railgun.
Shut up, Eric growled.
He waved a finger at Dave and Jesse.
Your time will come. You'll see. You traitors will be crying then.
Dave grabbed Jesse's shoulder and squeezed.
Stay cool, Jesse. This piece of crap isn't worth it. Don't do it.
Alarmed about breakdowns in discipline now that soldiers saw themselves as nothing but farmers, UNF had cracked down on fighting. Anyone who got into a fight, regardless of who started it, spent time in a hard labor camp. The prospect of building roads in the steaming jungle of Lemuria was an effective deterrent to fighting. For now. Jesse relaxed slightly, still ready if Eric threw a punch.
You're right, Ski. Thanks for reminding me.
To Eric, he said,
if y'all want to fight the hamsters, you sleepers best get at it then.
Leave us out of it, Jesse smirked.
We don't want to be within 10 kilometers when the Ruhar turn where you're standing into a smoking crater.
We do want a good view, Ski added.
Oh, yeah, man. I wouldn't miss that, Jesse said with a laugh.
Eric flipped them off with both hands and stomped off without another word.
You think those sleeper idiots would have woke the hell up when the lizards burned out that big field last month? Jesse mused.
A Krestang destroyer had popped into orbit and used its masers on a broad sweep to burn out several fields that were growing human food on Lemuria. There were several villages on Lemuria now almost entirely populated by keepers. It wasn't an official designation, but most non-keepers had asked for transfer out. The biggest field that had been targeted was a keeper village. The masers had scorched an entire season of crops and killed 31 people. Keeping the faith hadn't spared the village from the Krestang's predations. That destroyer had not targeted any Ruhar areas before it jumped away. It had focused entirely on damaging the human food supply.
Jesse, save your breath. You can't reason with idiots like him. They'll tell you that keeper village got hit because the Krestang see all humans as traitors. Their answer is we all need to be keepers. Then the Krestang will come back like Santa Claus down the chimney to reward all the good little girls and boys, Dave said in disgust.
Yeah, Jesse nodded. Like the school board in my home county. The answer to every problem is always they need more money. Whatever they were trying would have worked, if only they had more money. They never stop to think maybe it's what they're doing that's the problem.
Amen to that, brother.
Dave held out a fist and Jesse bumped it.
They're like my Aunt Claire, Dave went on. When something bad happens to someone else, she says God is punishing them. When something bad happens to her, God is testing her faith. It's the perfect system. No matter what happens, she's right and everyone else is wrong. She must be a lot of fun at the Thanksgiving table, Jesse said.
Dave shook his head.
Aunt Claire doesn't get invited to Thanksgiving anymore. That's mostly because her new husband drinks too much and says stupid stuff. Last time they were there, he knocked the gravy boat onto the floor. The only one in the whole family who misses him is the dog.
Jesse laughed. That must have been the best dog Thanksgiving ever. Then he looked at the sky, and his good humor faded.
We're never going home, are we?
Never.
We can't. This just can't be real. Can it?
All I can say for sure is if we really have no hope of ever going home again. Dave glanced around warily. Eric had walked out of earshot, but he was talking with another keeper and shooting hostile looks in Dave's direction.
Discipline will be going to hell in a hurry around here.
Flying Dutchman. We had found the derelict Thuranan relay station right where Skippy said it would be. Before boarding, we checked out the interior with combots in case the Thuranan had left any booby traps. The little green men had not bothered to booby trap the place. They had stripped it of anything useful before they left. That left a perfect training environment for us. Major Smythe wasted no time in putting his Spec Ops team through practice runs, and I joined them, not because I fantasized about being a badass Special Forces soldier. I was realistic about that. I joined the practice runs because I wanted to see firsthand what Smythe's team would be facing. After a walkthrough, we get into our two dropships to practice an assault for the first time. The dropship was crammed with people. We'd removed the seats to get in as many people as we could. The only thing holding us in place was webbing. That was also our only cushioning when the dropship was maneuvering. Strapped in, I was putting my helmet on and banged it into the helmet of the person next to me.
Sorry, I said.
No problem, sir, she replied.
Her name was Lauren Poole. She was one of the U.S. Army Rangers who was new to the merry band of pirates. I suspected that Smythe had assigned her to babysit me. She kept popping up next to me in training.
It doesn't bother you to be upside down like that? I asked.
In order to cram people in, some people were hanging upside down from the dropship ceiling. To get loose, we all had to cut the webbing, and I was concerned that would create snag hazards. That was one thing we would discover in practice.
No, she replied with a twinkle in her eyes. I started gymnastics when I was 8 years old. Sometimes it feels like I've spent half my life upside down, sir.
All right. I shook my head and pulled down the faceplate of my helmet. Let's do this.
This is still going to be bloody hard, Smythe said as he took off his helmet. His short hair was plastered to his scalp by sweat.
I nodded, trying to catch my breath. We had just finished the sixth practice assault, the sixth time we had run through the final plan. This was after we tested five other plans multiple times. After the fourth exhausting day, I had lost count of how many times we had practiced various plans. I was worn out, and I wouldn't even be participating in the actual assault, so my role in practice was as an observer. What I had observed was not encouraging. Skippy acted as the red team, our opponent,
and he assured us that he was dumbing down his reactions to match the Theranan cyborgs assisted by their AI. The combots that Skippy controlled were still lightning fast and deadly accurate. We had to use surprise, sheer numbers, and maximum firepower to accomplish the objective. On the first practice run, we had failed. The last of our special forces died before getting into the core of the station from which Skippy could access and shut down the station's AI. The second practice run was worse. We failed to breach the docking bay on our first attempt, and everyone died before they could leave the dropships. Having only two dropships was a serious limitation. Both had to act as transports, each crammed tight with spec ops people and combots. The interiors of both dropships had been stripped. No chairs remained. People were held in place by webbing to be cut away when they wanted release. After our failure to breach the docking bay on the second attempt, we tried the Dutchman making a micro-jump to position the ship in front of the docking bay so the ship could hammer the doors open with her powerful masers. That third practice attempt ended with what at first seemed like a victory. Three of our special forces survived to penetrate the station's core, and Skippy was able to shut down the Theranan AI. Unfortunately, the Dutchman got blown up in the practice run, so it was a failure. Skippy warned us that his calculations showed we would lose the ship 92% of the time. Our beat-up star carrier could not survive combat at close range. So we went back to the original plan. As soon as our stealth dropships opened fire on the docking bay doors, the Dutchman would jump away and await an all-clear signal. The fourth, fifth, and sixth practice assaults were successful in that at least one person survived to reach the station's core. The fifth assault had the best result, because in the end there were five special forces and three combots left combat effective. This wasn't working. It's too difficult, Major, I agreed with Smythe when we had finished stowing our gear back aboard the Dutchman. Any operation that incurs 90% casualties is unacceptable, even if the survival of humanity might be at stake. The problem is that we lose too many people and combots while breaching the docking bay, Smythe observed, and then getting from the docking bay into the station proper. After that, we don't have the massed firepower to overwhelm the enemy defenses. It becomes a short war of attrition. Do we lose people and combats faster than we can advance? I know. I did. I'd been there. I'd seen combots go offline and people's armored suits go stiff as Skippy declared them dead. Maybe there's another way to breach that docking bay. Fly troops in just with suits, ahead of the dropships, Smythe mused. You've done an extensive space dive, sir. Yes, and I wouldn't recommend it. Major, let's get some rest tonight and try it fresh again in the morning. I would rather have another go at it today, sir. Smythe's tone indicated that I wanted a break because I was not Special Forces. Yes, you do, because you spec ops types are always go, go, go. When we conduct the actual assault, we'll do it with freshly rested soldiers. We'll rest tonight, then add fresh troops to the simulation tomorrow. Smythe nodded curtly, unconvinced. I will get up early tomorrow, said Smythe, who got up early every morning. I want to get the equipment checked out early. That will save us time that we can use for practice. I'll join you, I responded. Joe gets going a lot quicker in the mornings, Skippy chimed in cheerily, since he stopped shaving down there. It saves a lot of time. Damn it, Skippy, I don't shave down there. That's what I just said, you dum-dum. Man, open your ears and listen once in a while, he grumbled. Anyway, aren't those hairs already curly? Do you really need a curling iron down there? What? I don't... It's not... I sputtered while the team laughed uncontrollably. Fine, whatever. Don't complain to me the next time you burn your thighs with that iron. I protested, feeling my face growing red already. Most of the special forces with us were new to the merry band of pirates. They didn't know how Skippy loved to make jokes at my expense. Shaking my head and holding up my hands, I walked out with what little dignity I had left. I'll see you at 0500, Major Smythe. Paradise. As a special treat, the residents of Fort Rakovsky, population 19, learned there would be a U.S. Army general visiting them the next day. They learned this information not from UNF HQ or the general staff, but from the grapevine of villages the general had already visited on the tour. Since the general was traveling by Humvee and there were few roads in the formerly impenetrable jungles of Lemuria, it was easy to predict where the general would be going next. While it would have been nice for the general staff to announce visits ahead of time, his staff expected the Z-Phone network to do the announcing for them. Any village that was caught off guard had to be either not paying attention or was very much disliked by their surrounding villagers. Either way, such an incident would tell the general and his staff that something was seriously amiss. So the residents of Fort Rakovsky had the joy of spending a day of their off-duty time straightening up the village. Uncompleted hooches were worked on through the night, and all the buildings were cleaned. The already minimal amount of trash was consolidated. Personal garden plots were weeded once again, and selected ripe fruits and vegetables were picked a day ahead of the normal schedule. Someone found paint and used the back of a crate to make Fort Rakovsky signs to point on the roads coming into the village from east and west.
"This is the best it's going to get," Dave Chaika said while looking around the village's only street with a frown.
"It's good enough," Jesse Coulter assured his buddy. "Here they come."
Around a corner of the road came three Humvees and a large truck, with lead vehicle flying both the UNEF and American flag. National flags were not encouraged, but this was the American sector of Lemuria, and a U.S. flag flew from a pole in the center of Fort Rakovsky. To avoid excess wear and tear on the priceless and irreplaceable fabric, the flag was normally kept wrapped in plastic in a box and only taken out for special occasions, like the rare times when people from another village came to Fort Rakovsky to trade and there was a woman with them. In those cases, the village was scrubbed top to bottom with far more vigor than was given to any visiting general. The general made a cursory inspection of the village, then walked over to check the fields, his chief interest on the tour. Mostly he wanted to see what soldiers were growing on their personal plots of land. After an hour, he came to the extensive plot that Jesse and Dave shared with three other guys.
"Impressive," General Marcellus observed. "This land belongs to the five of you?"
"The five of us work this land, sir. We get more done when we work together. But the land belongs to six people," Dave said.
The keeper, who had been a problem, had arranged a transfer to another village, and his replacement got along well with everyone.
"Six?"
Marcellus looked at the five men who were proudly showing their healthy personal crops.
"The other guy doesn't work?"
"He doesn't work the land, sir," Jesse explained. "He's good at fixing things, so he lets us work his land in exchange for a cut of the crops. He repairs and maintains equipment for us and other villages around here, and they trade stuff in exchange for his labor. We get a cut of whatever he gets in trade."
"I see. Captain Rivera, a word, please."
Marcellus walked a short distance with his staffer and frowned.
"This is a problem. This mechanic is trading away land that UNEF provided to him instead of using it to increase the food supply. He is not performing his assigned tasks," General Marcellus declared.
"Excuse me, sir, but I believe he is performing his assigned tasks during his duty hours," Captain Rivera said. "His personal activities are performed during his off-duty time."
"We gave people personal plots of land so they could grow food, Captain, not to use it as an excuse to slack off. Remind me again why I have an economist on my staff, and why the Marines sent an officer to Harvard to study economics in the first place?"
"Because, sir, the United States Marine Corps is a forward-thinking organization, and they anticipated Earth would be invaded by aliens, leaving a major force trapped off-world to develop its own independent economy," Rivera said with a deadpan expression. "My master's degree is in management. Economics was my undergrad major."
"And you signed up for the Marine Corps?"
Marcellus shook his head in wonderment. Rivera grinned.
"It turns out there are not a lot of practical applications for a bachelor's degree in economics."
"Did you consider the Coast Guard?"
"I wanted to see the world, sir. Seeing other worlds is a bonus."
"Then use your Harvard training to explain to me why I shouldn't discipline a soldier for trading away land that was given to him for the purpose of growing food."
"Because, sir, he is making the best use of the resources available to him, including his skill set. He might be terrible at farming, but he is good at fixing and maintaining equipment. If he used his off-duty time to grow crops, we would only have one more unskilled farmer. With the arrangement he has devised, his plot of land is being put to its best use, and his skills are being used to make people who are farming more productive by providing them with reliable equipment. Specialization of labor is key to an efficient economy. Everyone does what they do best. Eventually, sir, we will need to establish a form of currency. This barter economy of people trading corn for tomatoes and so on is inherently inefficient."
Marcellus looked at the sky and muttered to himself,
Some days I wish I was still a private carrying a rifle. Life was so simple back then.
Yes, sir, Rivera said simply, because there wasn't anything else to say.
Back in the Humvees, Captain, Marcella said. We have another four of these villages to visit today.
Touring villages might not benefit the residents in any way, but they were opening Marcellus's eyes. His intel report back to UNFHQ should open some eyes there. His greatest concern was that as soldiers became full-time farmers, people were going to increasingly question what authority UNF had over them. Eventually, the military command and control arrangement would give way to, he shuddered to think, democracy, elections, politics.
What, he asked himself, was this world coming to? This alien world.
Flying Dutchman. An idea hit me at 0337 that morning. This time I literally did dream something up.
Hey, Skippy.
What?
Is it important? I'm watching a late-night infomercial about how I can get stains out of fabrics. It's not helpful, but it sure is funny.
That's great, Skippy. I have a question for you. Can you fake a high-security message from Theranan Military Command?
Please, Joe. Easier than you can get a red wine stain out of a white carpet.
Now, why would anyone install a white carpet in their house? And if they had white carpet, why would they buy red wine? Unless they bought white carpet and red wine just for an infomercial. I smell a conspiracy here, Joe.
And that mystery has confounded mankind for centuries, Skippy, I agreed.
Could you convincingly fake a message that the Dutchman is on a secret mission for the Theranan High Command or whatever, so we can fly dropships right into that relay station's docking bay?
Silence.
Skippy.
Listen, I'm sure that you could rewind that infomercial if you really...
Holy shit. Holy shit. Why didn't I think of that? Damn it. Joe. Joe, I hate my life. Oh, this is so humiliating.
That is a great idea.
Skippy, I promise that I won't tell anyone it was my idea.
Why, thank you, Joe.
Until breakfast. Thus reminding me of why I rightfully so very much hate you, Joe.
I love you too, Skippy.
Don't get too cocky, monkey. Of course I can create a convincing message with the proper Theranan multi-level encryption and military authentication codes. I did that while you were saying breakfast, which, because your monkey brain worked so slowly, I heard as b-ek-fath.
Got it, Skippy.
What's the problem?
We would need that station to receive the message before the Dutchman jumps in on their doorstep. Our modified star carrier would raise way too many suspicions if we just showed up and said, trust me.
Crap. So we need another ship to carry the message for us?
Yep.
And we can't transmit a message directly to that ship either, because any Theranan ship is going to look at us with great suspicion.
But you do have a plan, right? I asked, dreading the answer.
Certainly, and, well...
You are very much not going to like it.
Damn. Whenever I heard Skippy's nervous, well, it set off my spidey senses.
I very, very much did not like Skippy's plan to get a message loaded into a Theranan ship, but Smythe very much did like my plan for his Spec Ops team to gain access to a relay station docking bay without fighting for it. We changed the simulation so that our two dropships were invited into the docking bay by the Theranan, and we then only needed to breach the inner doors. 12 practice runs resulted in much improved results. Most times we took the station quickly, and even the practices that went comparatively badly achieved our goal. Casualties were still unacceptable to my mind. Even Smythe was bothered. My guess is that Spec Ops people are so used to being elite that they had a difficult time contemplating any sort of failure. Smythe reminded the Special Forces of three very important facts. First, the people aboard the Flying Dutchman were indeed very special forces, the absolute most elite and capable combat forces humanity had ever developed. Second, we would be operating on the enemy's territory, against well-prepared defenses in which the enemy had every advantage. And third, the enemy were genetically enhanced cyborgs with lightning-quick reactions and an instinctive link with their deadly combats. The fact that humans had any chance to capture a Theranan relay station was an enormous tribute to the dedication and training of the Spec Ops team. The 12th and last practice run resulted in only 24 casualties and a successful seizure of the station. Smythe told me he did not think further practices would yield better results. We now had a precise plan. Execution of the plan would be up to Smythe's team.
It sucked for me to think of sitting safely aboard the Flying Dutchman while my crew took the risks. Paradise. Jesse walked wearily from their private allotment up the hill to the village that had sprung up. Fort Rakovsky now boasted actual buildings made of wood logged from the jungle around them. Jesse and Dave were constructing their own dwelling that they called a hooch, out of timber and a sort of canvas. Eventually, they hoped to replace the canvas. It was only half-finished, but already beat the cramped tent they'd been living in for what seemed like forever now. As he came around the corner of a large tent and was startled, "Gah!" he pulled up short like he'd seen a snake. "What the hell is that?" In front of the hooch they'd been constructing off and on, Dave Chaika was sitting in the sunshine with a huge grin on his face. Sitting on a couch, the ugliest, most awful couch Jesse had ever seen in his entire life. He'd never even imagined a piece of furniture could be so ugly. It was covered in a wild, garish pattern of some flowers the hamsters liked. "It's a couch," Dave explained. "Our couch. The supply wagon came through. They had some furniture the hamsters discarded. I traded for it. Didn't cost us much."
"You bought that horrible thing?"
"Damsky, I've seen couches on the side of a highway that look better. That's after they got run over a few times and sat out in the sun and rain for years."
"Damn,"
he shielded his eyes. "I can't even look directly at that thing." Ski looked at where he was sitting. In truth, the couch had seen better days.
"You're exaggerating. It's not that bad."
"Bad?
It's heinous, man. We've got to get rid of it pronto. That thing is a crime against humanity."
"Come on, Pone." Ski used the shortened version of Jesse's nickname. "It's not that bad."
"Bad? It's hideous. Damn. My ma brought home a couch like that. It used to be her mother's, and I think it belonged to her mother's aunt before that. That couch was evil, man, I tell you. It sat in the living room. My father wouldn't even go in there. One night my ma comes home. My pa and I were trying to perform an exorcism like in that old movie. You've seen it, right? Ma walks in. We're standing there in the living room with a Bible and a cross shouting, 'The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.'"
Jesse broke up laughing while telling his own story, remembering his mother's expression. Looking at Jesse, Ski couldn't help laughing too.
"What happened?"
"That evil thing defeated us. Or we got the words wrong or something. My ma was not amused, and that damned couch was still there the next morning. Ma did compromise by putting a cover over the couch, so maybe we did chase that couch's evil spirit out of my ma. My pa still refused to sit on it."
"How about we get a priest or someone to perform an exorcism on this thing?" Ski offered.
He hated to give up the couch entirely. Furniture was on very tight supply on Paradise.
"A human exorcism won't work on an alien couch, Ski,"
Jesse explained the obvious, although he was taking a second look at the couch. It was so amazingly ugly that it was kind of cool.
"You know why the hamsters gave it up, don't you? It was ugly even to them. Maybe we can throw a coat of paint over it, a fabric dye."
"I don't know." Hesitantly, Jesse touched the fabric. "This alien stuff probably has some high-tech stain blocker. That isn't going to work."
"Pone," Ski lowered his voice. "We need real furniture. We can't keep living on old packing crates and busted up containers."
"That's been good enough for girls," Dave emphasized. "Expect guys to have at least a couch, you know?"
"Oh,
yeah, oh." Jesse's eyes grew wide as he imagined the possibilities.
"You are a freaking genius, Ski. Hey, you know what? That couch is so ugly that it's a, what do you call it? A conversation piece."
"There's only one other real couch in all of Fort Rakovsky," Dave pointed out.
"Hmm. You know what we need now?"
Jesse asked, suddenly looking at the couch in a new light.
"What?"
"A real coffee table."
"We don't have coffee. There's none left on Paradise."
"One thing at a time. Couch first, then coffee table. Then we invite girls over after we get the hooch finished."
Dave gave a big thumbs up to that.
Neither he nor Jesse mentioned that there were exactly zero women in Fort Rakovsky, population 19. The closest women were in Camp Toffler, a half-hour walk away. Women sometimes came to trade goods, and they saw women when they made the weekly drive into the big town of Fort Cherokee.
"What are you waiting for?" Jesse asked, suddenly no longer tired. "Let's get this couch undercover before it rains, and then we get working on finishing the hooch."
Flying Dutchman.
Dinner that night was cooked by the American Spec Ops team, and I had been thinking about it all day. They were serving steaks. Although the galley had a grill, these steaks were prepared steakhouse style. See it on one side, then the steaks go into an oven to bake, so they stay juicy. When they were put on a plate, the seared side goes up because it looks nicer. Anyway, we were having steak. Everything we ate aboard the Flying Dutchman was good. Each national team wanted to outdo the others, and Major Sims had loaded a wide variety of food into our cargo holds. Much of it was frozen or radiated, of course. We also had fresh herbs and vegetables from the hydroponics lab, which had begun as an experiment and now regularly provided fresh food. Skippy disapproved when he saw me skip the vegetable tray after my plate was weighed down by a juicy steak. "Joe, you need to eat your veggies," he scolded me from the speaker. "Duh," I responded. "Do you know how many veggies this cow ate?" "Tons. I'm getting my veggies in concentrated form."
"It doesn't work that way, sir," Sergeant Adams said as she scooped some green thing onto my plate. I should have known better than to get in line behind her.
"What is that?" I asked suspiciously.
"Brussels sprouts."
"Don't worry. They're not boiled to mush like school lunch Brussels sprouts. These are cooked in a pan with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and then they put a little bit of maple syrup on it for you. They're good. Get some salad, too."
"Is that an order, Staff Sergeant?"
She looked at my collar.
"Not when you're wearing that uniform, Colonel. It's a suggestion, not an order."
I put salad on my plate. And damn it, she was right. It turns out that Brussels sprouts are good, especially with maple syrup.
Chapter 8. Flying Dutchman. Chotek called a meeting to discuss how we were going to get the data we needed and how Skippy could load a message aboard a Tharannan ship. A message that would be delivered to a Tharannan relay station stating that a funny-looking shrunken star carrier would be arriving on a top-secret mission and that the relay station should open the dock and bay doors for a pair of dropships. The message would also state that the crew of the station had won a free cruise and all we needed was their credit card numbers. Okay, that last part I made up. When Skippy had said, "Well, heh-heh, you are very much not going to like it about this plan for us to plant a message in the computers of a Tharannan warship," I knew that I would not like this plan. What I did not know is that the thing I wouldn't like was Skippy not having a workable plan. "Skippy," I groaned in frustration, "you said I would very much not like your plan."
"Aha. I don't have a plan that will work, and you very much don't like that, right?"
"I'm just trying to keep you on your toes, Joe. There are many, many possible plans. However, none of them will actually work, unless I'm missing something."
"You've done this sort of thing before, Mr. Skippy," Chotek observed, sounding annoyed. He looked down at his tablet, consulting notes about our mission reports. "On your first mission, you used a series of micro-jumps to remain in proximity to a Tharannan battle group in order to download data about the military situation in the sector. On your second mission, you flew by a Tharannan tanker ship and obtained the rendezvous coordinates for the surveyor ship. You were also able to alter the tanker ship's computer so that it dropped flight recorder drones before each jump."
"Bing, bing, bing, bing!" Skippy rang a bell. "Winner, winner, chicken dinner!"
"You are correct, Chalky. I did do those things because I am Skippy the Magnificent. Doing those two things was much, much, oh so much easier than what we have to do next. Or what I have to do next, since you are not going to do anything useful while I do all the work, whatever that is."
"Why?" Chotek asked. It was a reasonable question. "Why is this significantly more difficult? The task appears to be no different from actions you have already performed very successfully."
"Ugh," Skippy groaned.
"Colonel Joe, do I truly have to waste my time explaining simple facts to the serial mascot?"
"Skippy," I replied, trying to be tactful, "you do need to explain the situation to the mission commander." I nodded toward Hans Chotek. "I think the rest of us, me included, would appreciate a more complete understanding of the difficulty involved." In this case, I did have to agree with Chotek. The task sounded relatively straightforward to me. Hopefully this time I could avoid an extended space dive that ended with me almost plunging into the atmosphere of a gas giant planet and peeing in my pants.
"Fine," Skippy huffed. "The first time was easy, because all I did was randomly skim data from the memory of a Tharannan command ship. It didn't matter what data I got, because I knew I would be able to piece together a very rough overview of the military situation in the sector.
A command ship would have basic data on battle group deployments right in the command ship's navigation system. I knew where to get the data I wanted, so I was able to reach in and scoop up whatever was on top. The second time, we approached a tanker, a ship with a much lower level of security than a warship. The data security and sensor acuity of a tanker is an order of magnitude more crude than a Theranin warship. In that case, again, I knew the data we needed would be in the ship's navigation system, and I knew that data would be queued up in a recent update. Easy in, easy out. Planting a virus in the tanker's computer was also easy, because the ship's cybersecurity was laughably crude. Like, their password was password. He paused to make a sound like taking a deep breath. This task will be, as I said, much more difficult. We need detailed fleet deployment plans, plus the crew rotation schedules for data relay stations across the sector. Only a warship will have that data, and I have to download the full data set. We can't afford to miss anything important. Then, I will need to plant a message in the ship's data bank. Theranin warship AIs are not stupid. Back when we micro-jumped around and I pulled data from the command ship, that ship's AI knew I was downloading data, and it actively resisted me. After we left, that AI would have thoroughly inspected the integrity of its data banks. If I had left a virus or planted a message, the AI would have found it. With the tanker, that ship's AI never knew I was there, so it never ran a diagnostic of its systems. What we need to do now is approach closely to a Theranin warship and maintain close contact for an extended time, like at least 3 to 5 minutes. So we can't just fly by. And whatever we do, the ship's AI can never suspect we were there. Can you enhance the stealth of a dropship? Chang asked, to get us close enough without being detected? I can enhance a dropship's standard stealth capability, but not enough, Skippy replied. Considering how close we need to get to a Theranin warship and how long we have to remain there, we will be detected. Joe, before you suggest we could do another space dive, that won't work this time. The only way to find the right ship is to wait near a wormhole. We could be waiting there for a month or more until I identify a ship that is a good candidate for us. After a month in a spacesuit, you would die of your own smell. Also, you would run out of oxygen and water. Avoiding another space dive was a relief to me. Hiding the dropship in a comet won't work this time either? No, Joe. A Theranin warship would never allow a navigation hazard like a comet near a wormhole. And a comet hanging near a wormhole and deep into stellar space would be awfully suspicious. Most likely, the Theranin would use a comet for target practice and blow it up. Scratch that idea. All right, Skippy. You've told us all the ideas that won't work. What ideas do you have for us to do this? My idea is to tell you monkeys to think up an idea, because I got nothing, Joe. I do not see how we can get close enough to a Theranin warship long enough for me to do the job without being detected. We have seen that your monkey brains have a certain cleverness that has proven useful, so do your thing, monkeys. Dream something up. The frown on my face matched those around the conference table. Then my frown deepened when I realized everyone was looking toward me. Hey, right now, I got nothing. I held up my hands defensively. We will, as you Americans say, Chang said with a smile, put our thinking caps on. Chang led us through a brainstorming session for the next 2 hours. We threw out all kinds of crazy, impractical ideas, and Skippy shot them all down. I even mentioned ideas that I knew would not work, in the hope of sparking a good idea from someone else. We suggested using more than one dropship, one creating a distraction while the other got close enough for Skippy to contact the ship's computer. Skippy said the Theranin would either detect both dropships and shoot first, or more likely jump away if they thought our dropships were a threat. We thought of somehow getting Skippy into a container that would be loaded aboard a Theranin warship, then he could somehow cause the container to be ejected later. I hated the idea of Skippy being out there on his own, and we would first have to find just the right ship first. Plus, how would we get a package aboard a Theranin warship? Hide Skippy inside a birthday cake to be delivered by FedEx? And you can see our ideas were getting pretty desperate and silly by that point. After 2 hours of us throwing out ideas ranging from wildly crazy to merely impractical, Chotek decided we should take a break. Our new mission commander gave me the impression that he was disappointed I hadn't already dreamed up an idea. Truthfully, I was disappointed in myself. And Skippy. Maybe there simply was not any way to sneak up on a Theranin warship, since they had been, you know, carefully designed to detect anyone and anything in their vicinity.
Duh.
We all went to the galley for much-needed refreshments. The Indian team was preparing lunch that would be ready in a couple hours. Whatever sauce they had simmering on the stove was making me hungry. I got a cup of black coffee and stood staring at my cup, hoping for inspiration. The cup just sat there in my hand, looking stupid and unhelpful.
Hey, Chang said with dismay. What is this?
He was pointing to a bowl marked sugar. When he took the lid off, instead of sugar, there were yellow packets of some sugar substitute.
Sugar is over here, sir, Adam said, pointing to a bowl that did not have any marking on it.
The bowl marked sugar doesn't have sugar in it, and the sugar bowl isn't marked?
Chang laughed sarcastically.
Why isn't the sugar in the bowl?
Holy shit. I gasped with shock, and everyone looked at me.
Colonel Chang, I interrupted him. Could we be overthinking this?
Chang looked surprised. Confused at my question, he pointed to the two bowls.
It seems pretty simple to me.
No, I'm not talking about the sugar. What I mean is, could we be overthinking how to approach a Tharanan warship?
Turning to Chotek, who was spooning loose tea leaves into a small silver basket thing, I asked, so what if the Tharanan see our dropship?
Chotek wasn't any more clued into the idea in my head than Chang had been.
Colonel Bishop, Chotek began in the tone of voice people use when speaking to a small child, you are proposing to deliberately reveal our presence to the Tharanan?
Not exactly, sir.
And I explained my idea.
Paradise. Cornpone looked up from pulling native paradise weeds out of the soil of their personal vegetable garden. The weeds not only choked out earth crops because native plants grew faster in the conditions and sunlight spectrum on paradise, they also encouraged growth of native soil microorganisms that were not helpful to earth plants. In order for earth seeds to grow in the dirt on paradise, the dirt first needed to be prepared with a soil conditioning mix that allowed the roots of earth plants to extract nutrients from the dirt. It was the still limited availability of soil conditioner, not seeds, that was the constraint on how much crops could be grown by UNEF. Since he had volunteered for an ag team with Dave Chaika, Jesse Coulter had learned far more than he thought there was to learn about growing plants and seeds and composting, more than he had ever wanted to learn. Being a farmer on an alien planet was a lot more complicated than sticking seeds in the ground and praying for rain. In the jungles of Lemuria, it rained every day, so getting enough rain was not a problem. Cornpone pushed himself to stand up and tilted his head.
Hey, Ski. You hear that?
What? Dave asked, while pinching buds off a tomato plant so the other buds would grow larger tomatoes.
Aircraft. More than one, Jesse declared.
He checked his e-phone. There were no alert messages, and no UNEF brass were scheduled to visit the hick town of Fort Rakovsky. Whenever high-ranking officers were in the area, people always received a warning from their fellow soldiers. UNEF brass, even the multi-star generals, rarely traveled by air anyway. They were limited to Humvees, unless the Ruhar provided aircraft for a very special occasion.
Dave stood up, brushing dirt off his knees. In the relative cool of the jungle morning, he was wearing shorts to avoid grinding down the knees of his long pants. The shorts had previously been long pants that had been sacrificed to become shorts and work gloves when the knees had worn through so badly that Dave had been unable to patch them one more time.
Yeah, I hear them now.
Not dropships.
No, Jesse agreed.
Dropship engines, which somewhat struggled in atmospheres, had a distinctive whine unless they were in stealth mode.
Maybe they're delivering the pizza we ordered 5 months ago.
Dave laughed.
If that's true, then that pizza is guaranteed free.
And no freaking tip for the driver, Jesse grinned.
I'm feeling generous. You can eat that 5-month-old pizza all by yourself.
Getting louder.
They can't be coming here, can they?
Dave looked around the glamorous expanse of Fort Rakovsky.
For what? Did somebody here grow a prize-winning tomato?
Not that I know of. Jesse shrugged.
And we don't have a critical medical case.
The Ruhar sometimes took care of medical cases that the very limited human medical facilities could not handle. Sometimes. Back when humans were working for the Kristang to push the Ruhar off the planet, the Ruhar had provided advanced medical care as a way to sow dissension between humans and their lizard patrons.
That tactic had worked, with the Ruhar going so far as to regrow the limbs of severely wounded humans, while the Kristang refused to provide any advanced medical care to their human clients. Even after the failed Ruhar raid in which Joe Bishop had shot down two Ruhar transport dropships, the Ruhar had continued to provide advanced medical care to humans. That free medical care became scarce after the Ruhar took the planet back, right at the time when human medical supplies began running severely low. Now, the Ruhar took on human medical cases only when UNEF HQ pleaded particularly loud and strenuously. The Ruhar no longer cared to bear the expense and effort on a campaign for winning human hearts and minds to their side. The humans had no choice and no power. It seemed like while the Ruhar were not actively enemies of humans on Paradise, they wished the problem of humans would simply go away. There were even wild rumors flying around the Z-Phone network that the Ruhar government was negotiating to hand the planet back to the Kristang and screw the humans in the process. Jesse thought that rumor was wild BS. He couldn't see the Ruhar giving up a planet so soon after sending so many warships to fight for it. Dave wasn't so sure about that. The war had been raging hot and cold for a very long time, and nothing that either side did would surprise him. The Ruhar and Kristang were, he reminded Jesse, aliens. Who knew how they thought?
"Damn, man. They are coming here," Jesse announced anxiously.
The sound of the aircraft was loud now. They were close and flying low, coming in from the north. As he listened, the sound of one aircraft increased, and a chicken gunship popped up above the tree line, climbing rapidly for altitude. The gunship would be flying high cover, and that was not a good sign. Without a word between them, Dave and Jesse dropped their spades and ran straight for the little village center. They were only halfway there, and joined by other people running in from the fields, when a buzzard transport ship appeared over the trees, flying half sideways. The door on the near side was open, and two Ruhar soldiers in body armor were in the doorway, holding rifles. The aircraft circled the village once, then set down, crabbing sideways to avoid landing on top of precious earth crops. As the engines spooled down to idle, Dave and Jesse halted with other people 50 meters away. Some people had their Z-phones out, shooting video of the unusual event. Others were calling friends in other villages, or even UNEF HQ. Jesse and Dave figured that if UNEF HQ or anyone else had useful information about why the Ruhar had landed in tiny Fort Rakovsky, they would have informed the village's residents already. The two Ruhar soldiers stepped down onto the ground, and one activated a translator. The slightly squeaky voice boomed out over the idling engines of the Buzzard.
"United States Army Specialists David Chaika and Jesse Coulter of the 10th Infantry Division will come with us immediately."
"What the hell?" Dave asked, shocked. Jesse slowly held his hands up.
"I don't know either, man."
He looked from the rifles of the Ruhar soldiers to the gun pods of the chickens circling above.
"But we better do as they say."
The Ruhar soldiers had not handcuffed Jesse and Dave. They also hadn't answered any questions either. "No matter," Jesse told Dave. The Ruhar soldiers were grunts like the two humans. They'd been given orders to pick up two specific humans and bring them somewhere. Grunts didn't need to know why. After attempting to speak with the Ruhar, which was difficult because the Ruhar had taken away their Z-phones, Jesse and Dave gave up.
"I don't think you were pronouncing that right," Jesse said quietly.
"Maybe," Dave admitted. His Ruhar was terrible. Like many humans on Paradise, Dave and Jesse had been learning the common Ruhar language using Z-phones as tutors. The Keeper faction, of course, thought any effort to learn to speak Ruhar was treason. Most Keepers were trying to learn Kristang, although human tongues found the harsh hissing undertones of lizard speech difficult to master.
"I don't think the problem was what I said. I think they don't want to talk with us."
The four sat mostly in silence for 2 hours while the Buzzard droned on and on, flying north. The only break was visits to the Buzzard's cramped bathroom. After 2 hours, one of the Ruhar unbuckled from his seat, stood up, and offered a Z-phone to Dave.
"Hip-hop?"
the hamster asked, pointing at the Z-phone. Dave and Jesse smiled to each other. Being cut off from Earth, humans on Paradise missed communications with loved ones back home. They missed foods that were not available on Paradise, and they missed music. New music. Music they hadn't already heard over and over.
There was an enormous library of music at their fingertips over the Z-Phone network, so soldiers could hear not only all the music they had brought to the stars with them, they could hear anything their fellow soldiers had brought. At first, Jesse thought that was great. He was able to hear music that was new to him. One night, he discovered a rare Johnny Cash live recording that he knew his father would love. Then even that got old. Jesse got so desperate to hear something new that he started listening to jazz, then big band music, classical, anything he could find. Ski drew the line when Jesse wanted to play polka music in their hooch one night. Ski had heard way too much polka while growing up, and he hated it. So they began trading music with the French, Indians, and Chinese. That broadened their musical horizons considerably. Some of it was even good. If you ignored the lyrics, you couldn't understand. The big breakthrough came when some unknown soldier, legend had it was a guy in the U.S. 3rd Infantry, who traded music with a Ruhar soldier. The Ruhar, it was quickly discovered, had no spoken word music like rap or hip-hop, and Ruhar soldiers went crazy for it. They couldn't get enough of that type of human music, and humans were often able to trade music for tools, clothing, and other goodies from the Ruhar. Some enterprising soldiers had formed hip-hop and rap acts to provide new music, and their biggest audience were the Ruhar. That was partly because their fellow humans said the music by groups like Ghost Soldiers was truly awful. The Ruhar thought all of it was new and different and great. "Hip-hop," Dave said with delight, and took the offered Z-phone. He fiddled with the controls until something he picked at random came from the speakers. It was hard to hear the music from the Z-phone's tiny speakers until the Ruhar took the Z-phone back, did something with it, and the music played over the speakers in the Buzzard's cabin. The unpadded cabin of the combat transport with its droning engines was not the best venue for listening to music. The two Ruhar didn't seem to mind. They sat swaying in their seats, heads bobbing in tune with the beat, trying to mouth the words. When the song finished, one of the Ruhar spoke.
"Dramas?"
it asked in the slightly squeaky hamster way. Jesse shook his head.
"Papa T."
"Papa T," the Ruhar repeated happily.
"Yep, you got it right," Jesse said.
Then, in broken Ruhar, he asked if the enemy soldiers knew where they were going, not expecting an answer. To his surprise, the Ruhar shook his head, and over the Z-phone translator said,
"They don't tell us anything."
"Amen to that, brother," Jesse responded, and on an impulse offered his fist. To his surprise, the Ruhar bumped fists with him.
"Ski," Jesse said, "play the man some tunes."
Dave got the Z-phone back and selected a playlist of major hit hip-hop tunes that the Ruhar might be familiar with, plus some lesser-known favorites. The four of them rocked out, singing along when they knew the words. By the time the buzzard landed, the Ruhar appeared sympathetic. They slapped the two humans on the shoulder, looking almost sorry.
"Don't worry," one of them said through a translator. "I think this is only questions for you."
Questions about what, the Ruhar couldn't say. And Dave and Jesse were left dumbfounded. What questions could the Ruhar have for two low-ranking farmers? The mystery deepened when the two were ushered into a low building near the airfield, then ordered to sit in a windowless conference room. The room had three chairs and a desk. They sat in the two chairs on one side and waited half an hour until the door opened and a female Ruhar walked in. She smiled a toothy Ruhar grin, slid a pair of Z-phones across the table, and sat down.
"Greetings. I am Baterna Logelia, the civilian deputy administrator of this planet. Your friend Joe Bishop called me the Burgermeister."
A light bulb went on in Jesse's head. He spoke into the Z-phone translator.
"Oh, yeah. Bish said something about you. He was talking with you when his embedded observation team was in that village, I forget the name, sorry."
"Teskor," she said with a smile.
"The village was Teskor. Did Joe Bishop tell you what the two of us talked about?"
"No," Dave said with a look at Jesse.
"He said it wasn't anything important. You were like the mayor of the village or something."
She laughed.
"That is what I let Joe believe. Later he learned the truth. Gentlemen, you are here today because of Joe. When is the last time you saw him?"
"The last time?" Ski repeated the question because he couldn't entirely believe the translator had worked correctly.
"Before we left Camp Alpha. That is the training base planet we were on before we came here," he explained. "I am familiar with Camp Alpha," she said. "You did not see him after that?"
No. Jesse shook his head. Bish, that is Joe, got promoted to sergeant and left our fire team, left our unit. We shipped off Camp Alpha separately. That's the last we saw him. When we landed here, we were deployed to different locations.
I understand. She seemed satisfied with that answer. And when is the last time either of you communicated with Joe? Communication of any kind?
Wow, that had to be... Dave looked at Jesse before answering. The day before he got arrested. Maybe the day before that. The three of us talked. He told us he had a cushy job as a colonel planting potatoes. Then he got arrested because he, you know, refused the lizard's orders to kill hamster, Ruhar civilians. No offense, ma'am.
No offense taken, Dave Chaika. We know humans call us hamsters, and we in turn have a slang term for your species. Are you certain that you did not receive any communication from Joe after he was arrested? No communication of any kind, not even through other people? Perhaps he sent you a message after he escaped from jail.
Escaped? Jesse exclaimed. Then he grew angry. Joe didn't escape. Don't lie to us like that. You killed him when you hit that jail. You killed him after he tried to protect you hamsters from the Kristang.
Jesse stopped talking when Dave grabbed his arm. The Burgermeister did not seem to be insulted.